This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headlee, host of On Second Thought at Georgia Public Broadcasting, sitting in for Joshua Johnson in Washington. Republicans have dominated the headlines with their infighting and tweeted insults, but Democrats found their way onto the front pages this week. It turns out the DNC funded the research, at least partially, that led to the release of a salacious dossier on Donald Trump and his alleged ties to Russia. Top Democrats, including Hillary Clinton, deny that they knew the DNC was paying for it. We'll talk about how both political parties made news, for better or worse, this week. Much more as well on today's Friday News Roundup. Joining me for a look back at what I say on my show, what the heck happened this week, is CNN congressional reporter Lauren Fox. Happy Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also with us is Washington Post political reporter Eugene Scott. Hi, Eugene.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
And Olivier Knox is the chief Washington correspondent for Yahoo News. Hi, Olivier.
I like what the heck happened. I think it's totally appropriate. You could do that any moment of this year.
That is pretty much true. It fits even on the weekends.
Love it.
Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona announced he will not seek re-election. It was a passionate speech from the Senate floor on Tuesday.
When we remain silent and fail to act, when we know that silence and inaction is the wrong thing to do because of political considerations, because we might make enemies, because we might alienate the base, because we might provoke a primary challenge, because ad infinitum, ad nauseum, when we succumb to those considerations in spite of what should be greater considerations and imperatives in defense of our institutions and our liberty, we dishonor our principles and forsake our obligations. Those things are far more important than politics.
Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee also told CNN this week that he thinks President Trump will be remembered for, quote, debasing the nation. Corker says he is also not running for re-election. And then you can add into that mix Senator John McCain and former President George W. Bush. They had some very explicit critiques that were not explicitly mentioning President Trump. So there's two kinds of criticisms here. There's those from either former politicians or people who are about to be former politicians. Do those carry weight, Lauren?
I think that they matter in the institution in the sense that Jeff Flake and Bob Corker are both respected members of the U.S. Senate. I mean, Bob Corker is the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. But when you talk to staffers and when you talk to other members, there's a little bit of frustration that this is distracting from their ultimate goal, tax reform. They talk about that constantly, like we need to keep our eye on the ball. We need to keep moving forward with that. We can't be distracted by sort of these bigger question debates. But obviously, you know, it says something that you have to be on your way out the door to feel comfortable talking about how uncomfortable you are with the president of the United States. And of course, they didn't say him by his name.
Well, John
Jeff
McCain
Flake
and,
did not say his name in his speech.
But we all knew what he was talking about.
Yeah.
And Bob Corker has absolutely named President Trump. But Eugene, Lauren just said you kind of have to not be a sort of current politician in order to make these kind of critiques. Would you agree with that?
Certainly. And I used to cover politics in Arizona, and actually when Flake got elected to the Senate. So it's been fascinating watching how the base has changed so much over the last 4 years in terms of being supportive of Flake and now being supportive of Trump. I think it just speaks so much to how the party as a whole has changed. But the thing I try to tell people left of Trump who are getting so excited with Corker and getting excited with McCain and Flake, watch how they actually vote. Watch what they say regarding the conversation related to impeachment. Because if they are only just saying, you know, we're not on his side verbally, but their actions say differently, it doesn't matter that much.
So what are we to make, Olivier, about the silence of other Republicans who are still planning to run for office?
Back in January, Democrats said that Republicans would hold their nose, look the other way, really just ignore all of the problematic aspects of the Trump presidency in order to get tax cuts through. And, well, this week, that actually became the official Republican position. Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, saying, you know, ignore the tweets, ignore the day-to-day personal stuff. We are focused on this tax proposal. So that's a big part of it. The other big part of it, I think my two colleagues have alluded to, is Donald Trump's a lot tighter with the base than the establishment Republicans in Congress. So, you have a situation in which people who want to run again know for a fact that even though he's not doing well overall in job approval, he still has pretty high approval among Republican voters, 76, 77%, something like that. To Eugene's point, there's Corker came out, Bob Corker came out and described the budget as a sham budget.
Yeah.
He voted for it. So you have this disconnect between some of this rhetoric and the way these guys are actually carrying out the Trump agenda.
And at the end of the day, they're still Republicans. They're still going to vote like Republicans. They are not going to start, you know, voting like Democrats. And I think, you know, having a concern about the way that the president is running this country and having a concern about tax policy that they've all been campaigning on for the last 10 years are two very different things.
The really interesting thing from Corker was he alluded in an interview, I believe with CNN, to the idea that his committee would look into adding a layer between the president and the ability to launch
the CNN interview.
A nuclear strike. That was fascinating.
Yeah.
If they start doing things like that, I mean, remember, Republicans have overridden this president a couple of times, notably on sanctions against Russia.
Yeah.
Jeff Flake's before he knew he was retiring, put out a book really aggressively criticizing Donald Trump. So we have seen moments when congressional Republicans are willing to confront this president. It's just that on balance, they haven't.
Yeah.
Well, since you're talking about taxes, let's move on to talk about taxes, because the House voted really narrowly, I mean by four votes, to adopt a Senate-passed Republican budget plan that clears the way for what they're hoping will be a sweeping overhaul of the tax code. For both businesses and individuals, they say it could add about $1.5 trillion to the national debt. But Lauren, what actual specifics do we have about this tax plan?
So they've laid out a detailed sort of summary of what some of the deductions that they might take away look like. But here's the important part. The vote yesterday was very narrow, in part because they did unveil some details, including a repeal or cut of the so-called SALT deduction. That's your state and local property taxes that you get to write off
for
your federal returns. Very popular, especially in places where you pay high taxes, like New York, New Jersey. Well, turns out that there are a lot of Republican House members from those places who are not pleased with that part of the tax plan that Republicans have unveiled. And while a lot of details haven't been unveiled, I think the fact that there was such wide rebuke of this plan and there were so many Republicans who were willing to vote against the budget because of it shows you that, like, when they actually unveil a bill, which is supposed to happen on November 1st, there's going to be a lot to pick apart, and it's going to be very difficult for them to hold Republican members because there is a
20
constituency.
20 Republicans already voted against this.
Yep.
I want to read a comment from Matthew in Baltimore who says, regarding the passage of the Republican budget plan this week, the framework they've used will again allow the Senate to pass comprehensive tax reform with just a simple majority. How is this possible, Eugene?
Well, I think it's possible in part because we're in such tribalistic times and partisan times where no matter how many people have problems with Trump and the ideas that get put forward, I think ultimately we're not going to see a bunch of Republicans jumping to vote against this plan, in part because I think we're seeing people who are really afraid of not winning re-election if they come off as not being on the Trump train. I think something in terms of the threats in terms of having Bannon or someone being put forward who could be non-establishment, I think at the end of the day, it's going to get people, despite their discomfort with ideas, to just ultimately get on the same side of their party at the end of the day.
Well, on that note, let me ask you, Olivia, because we have this comment from Chip in Richmond who is having trouble with what we were just talking about. He says, please ask your panelists to explain to mere mortals outside the D.C. greenhouse how someone like Lindsey Graham, who earlier called out Trump for his race baiting and sexism, is now climbing in bed with the Donald. To paraphrase Joseph Welch, who called out an earlier senator in Washington, have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last? Jeff Flake also quoted that same comment. So maybe help Chip understand what you were talking about earlier.
Well, first of all, if we're a greenhouse, that's at least an upgrade from a zoo or a swamp, I think. I would say that what you've seen since the beginning, since Donald Trump announced his candidacy, you've seen a bunch of different Republican strategies for, I'll say, dealing with him. You've seen the huggers. Ted Cruz embraced him early on in the primary process. You've seen the confrontationalists, the Jeb Bush types. That hasn't changed. In Congress, you have sort of a taxonomy of these different Republican responses. You have some who criticize him, you have some who embrace him, and you've got Lindsey Graham, who's kind of straddling this weird mix where he goes golfing with a guy that just a week and a half earlier he was describing as a problem for national security. It's it's been very interesting to watch Graham because he has legitimate and deep-running policy differences with this president, especially in national security.
Yeah.
But he is shifting with the times. You know, he's done more embracing his golf. He played golf with the president, praised the president's golf game, which is, you know.
Golf, the great unifier.
Yeah, I guess.
Unless Obama does it.
I have trouble with the windmill hole myself, but it's been interesting to watch. And I don't know at the end of the day what the Lindsey Graham White House relationship is going to be. And you know what? Lindsey Graham doesn't either.
Interestingly enough, you can always send your comments to us and we welcome them and your questions as well. We'll have more of the Friday News Roundup just ahead. We'll get an update on hurricane recovery in Puerto Rico and this week's round of sexual harassment claims against powerful men. My guests are Washington Post political reporter Eugene Scott, Olivier Knox, who's chief Washington correspondent for Yahoo News, and CNN congressional reporter Lauren Fox. I am Celeste Headlee. I'm sitting in for Joshua Johnson. It's so good to be with you. You are listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headlee, author of We Need to Talk, sitting in for Joshua Johnson today. Let's jump back into the Friday News Roundup. We have Lauren Fox of CNN, Olivier Knox of Yahoo News, and The Washington Post, Eugene Scott, and you, of course. What questions do you have about the week's big stories? You can tell us on our Facebook page, and you can also catch there a live video stream of today's Roundup. So let's stay in the Trump White House. The president's condolence call to Gold Star widow Maisha Johnson was still in the news this week. Johnson sat down with ABC's Good Morning America to talk about that call with the president.
What he said was...
The president.
Yes, the president said that he knew what he signed up for, but it hurts anyways. And I was... It made me cry because I was very angry at the tone of his voice and how he said it. Like he couldn't remember my husband's name. And that would hurt me the most because if my husband is out here fighting for our country and he risks his life for our country, why can't you remember his name?
After that interview, the president tweeted this, quote, "I had a very respectful conversation with the widow of Sergeant LaDavid Johnson and spoke his name from the beginning without hesitation." End quote. So, Lauren, why is this persisting in the headlines? Why is this still a topic of a conversation?
I think because the president continues to combat the widow of an American
pregnant soldier.
Yeah. On Twitter constantly. It does not stop. There's no sort of calling it a truce, just letting her have the last word. And I think that as long as he's talking about it, it's going to continue to be an issue. And I mean, that was a heartbreaking interview. Yeah. It's just, this woman has lost so much. I mean, I think the video footage of her meeting her husband on the tarmac, I mean, that is just going to stick with Americans when they think about it. And I think when you have the president continuing to tweet about, oh, I was very respectful on the call, it just, it doesn't jive with what people are feeling when they see those images, when they hear her interview.
Olivier, does that have an effect on military families and military members?
I think so, but I guess I think another reason that it's sticking around is that there are so many unanswered questions about the raid in which LaDavid Johnson lost his life. And so there's this constant churn in the background of like what we're finding out about what went wrong in that operation. And that's keeping it in the headlines as well. That makes a lot of this this stay very relevant. The families of deployed soldiers that I know dread even the possibility of this phone call. They don't want to see people in uniform walk up their driveway. I don't know. I don't pretend to speak for them in terms of what the president's feud with this particular widow does. I will note that, the message, as described by the widow, the message from the president resembles the message that that people get, which is to say, take comfort from the fact that your spouse was doing what they most wanted to do in the world, where they wanted to do it the most, with whom they wanted to do it the most. Sort of as an effort to say, you know, they were making a sacrifice for something they really believed in. And so you can kind of see the contours of where what the president was trying to say. That's what John Kelly tried to explain. I don't want to speak for the families of people who are deployed, but it's very clear to me that They dread getting this phone call. And frankly, we're not paying enough attention as a society to all the different places in which we have young men and women in harm's way.
Well, I was actually looking at a poll this morning in Military Times, and it said their approval ratings among the military, among the publication's readings of Trump, readers of Trump are actually going down. And so I don't know if that directly correlates to this issue, but I think it's worth paying attention to. One reason this is getting a lot of traction is because the president has a history of using the military and veterans as this sacred community, this identity group, when he wants to attack other groups. So he's used the military and veterans against NFL players and against undocumented immigrants and against the transgender community. And so when it comes, an opportunity arrives for him to show his allegiance and his value for this group, and he appeared to drop the ball so epically, that brings into question how genuine his concerns and words were.
I want to move on to a topic that one of our listeners at least says isn't getting enough attention. Virginia writes us an email that says, if 140 people die a day from opioids and Trump has waited in town now to start helping, that means 40,000 folks have died since he took office. That's more than a broken campaign promise. Still no plan. No funding. In a speech at the White House Thursday, President Trump officially declared the opioid crisis a public health emergency. That includes things like a campaign to discourage drug use among young people. But Lauren, there is no funding in this declaration. Does the funding need to come?
Absolutely. I think one of the things we have to remember is that Congress still has to allocate money in this situation. This is not a national emergency. Those two things are very different, and they mean different things. And while the president has sort of been saying on, you know, in various interviews that he thinks that the opioid crisis is a national emergency, yesterday's declaration did not go as far as that. The money is not going to be backed up by his announcement yesterday. What he's talking about is more just raising awareness and, you know, more of a media blitz, honestly, about making people aware. And I think after the campaign in 2016, I think people were aware. And I think a lot of candidates actually were going to New Hampshire and learning about this with voters at town halls. People would come and talk to them. And it became sort of a national story during the campaign. I think people realize it's a problem. Now we have to do something about it.
So yesterday I was paying a lot of attention on social media to how much attention voters feel like this issue is very geographic and racially targeted. So we think of New Hampshire and we think of rural voters and we think of white working class voters. But there's data showing that the opioid epidemic is affecting black and brown communities in inner cities as well, and Native Americans on reservations. And those areas aren't getting attention either, much less funding. And so there's this idea that this is a very Trump-focused response to an issue that goes way beyond his base, and there's doubt that he's going to follow through with that among some voters.
What was really striking about, to me, from the speech yesterday at the White House was that it could have been, you change a couple of names, change a couple of drug names, and you have a speech that could have been given in 1982.
Yeah.
You have a just say no enforcement-based response to the crisis. That was very
1982 under the Reagan administration with the crack cocaine.
It was really striking. It was really striking how much of this could have been done then. I mean, there was a very emotional core to it, which when he described his brother who succumbed to alcoholism, but it was otherwise very striking, very Trumpian, very, you know, just say no, drugs are bad. Mm-hmm. And that was really interesting to me, because if you talk to people in Congress who are close to this, or even some of the president's own advocates, Chris Christie, they will talk about treatment. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They'll talk about things like that. People in Congress are angry in part because the Trump spending proposals would cut treatment. They would mm-hmm. reduce federal programs that actually go directly to managing this crisis. And so the president could have come out yesterday and say, I would like Congress to spend X. And that didn't happen.
A question here from Margaret on Facebook, who says, explain the dossier and why the GOP now thinks Hillary Clinton and the DNC are actually involved with Russia, the DNC, the Democratic National Committee. So let's talk about that. The Washington Post reported early this week that the Democratic National Committee and the Clinton campaign helped fund that notorious Steele dossier. That's the document that contains a great deal of information that helps tie the Trump campaign to Russia. Some of it's been confirmed. Some of it has not. Lauren, how different is this transaction from the opposition research all campaigns invest in?
Well, I think that that's kind of the major question right now, and like the debate that everyone's trying to grapple with. Is this somehow different because we knew about this dossier before? And we should again say, like, not every claim in this dossier, many of them are not verified at this point. And, you know, we should always be careful when we're talking about something like this. But I think that that's unclear, is that campaigns spend money all the time for opposition research. It happens at every level. All of this sort of happens in a way that I think Americans would be pretty uncomfortable with to some extent. And when it comes out, it sort of makes all of us think, like, is this really what American campaigns look like today?
And then political reporters say yes.
Yes,
that is
they
what
are.
They...
Yes. But I think that, you know, everyone's trying to figure that out at this moment. Like, is this different somehow? And I think the fact that this was such a high profile story before it came out, before it came out, who was sort of behind funding part of it, I think it makes it really tough.
Interestingly enough, Eugene, this whole investigation on the opposition research started in 2015 and was initially funded by a wealthy
right.
Republican donor. So how do we now make our way towards the Clinton campaign?
Well, I'm really interested in figuring out, if we ever can, who this Republican donor is. And I think what one of the reasons we make our way to the Clinton campaign, because as more information has come forward, we now know that there were more diverse funding sources than we originally thought, and there could be more as well. And I think one reason we're also making our way to the Clinton side of it is because this allows for Trump and Republicans who have had problems with the Russian narrative on them to focus on the fact that they believe the Clinton campaign was working with a foreign government to what they would say undermine an election. Whether or not that's actually true, that's just not even clear at this point. There's so many more questions we have than answers right now. And I think the more important questions, with all due respect to everyone involved, is whether or not it's true. Not the funding sources, but whether or not these claims are true. And we need to figure out what kind of impact they could have on our country and the way the current president governs.
But is it possible, Olivier, that there was a violation of campaign finance law?
It's possible. There's my colleague Mike Isikoff is reporting that there's a nonpartisan group that's saying that the Clinton campaign violated at least the spirit of campaign disclosure because the money was labeled something like legal services or something like that. So, yeah, there was a... The FCC lets people get away. The FEC lets people get away with a fair amount on that score. It's not uncommon for campaigns to conceal their spending and that kind of labeling. But of course, that raises some questions. I do want to say, and I really don't like media and media violence, but we knew that Democrats were connected to the funding of what became the Steele dossier. We knew that in October when the dossier was released. We knew that again in January. So. It's not the first time we've heard connections to the Democrats. We just have a lot more precision on which Democrats and how.
Let's talk about immigration. President Trump signed an executive order Tuesday to resume refugee admissions, but has increased the vetting process. The administration announced also a new partial ban on refugees from 11 higher risk countries. We don't know who those countries are. This new order comes as the administration's 4-month ban on refugee admissions expires. So walk us through this quickly, Lauren, so we can just get to the basics of where do we stand with refugees. There's a cut now, and then we're now at our lowest levels, are we not?
We are. And I think that that's one of the things that we're going to start seeing moving forward. Setting the refugee number is up to the president of the United States. That's always been the case. President Barack Obama got a lot of criticism that he increased the number during the Syrian refugee crisis, which is still ongoing, of course. But, you know, it got national attention. And I think, you know, refugees became, I think, the issue for Donald Trump in 2016. And I think that's why it continues to be such a thing that his administration continues to hammer down on and continues to lower the number of refugees admitted into this country, creates sort of this, quote, extreme vetting moving forward.
I'm Celeste Headley in for Joshua Johnson. You are listening to 1A. Where does this stand, though, in terms of which countries are higher risk and which are not, Eugene?
Well, from what I understand, we're still waiting to see what some of the countries are in terms of which are higher risk and which aren't. And quite frankly, I think people are still waiting to see how the countries on the last ban were chosen. They're just questions. People are not sure why countries are targeted, why they're at risk, and why countries that other people have found to be more problematic may have been left off of the ban.
So we got a list of the government departments that opposed lowering the number of refugees. I mean, they were the Department of Defense, the Department of State, the Office of the Vice President. So who was it that has convinced the president to go ahead with it anyway?
Well, he has a lot of people in his orbit who dislike immigration in general and refugees in particular. One of his top advisors, Stephen Miller, has been a voice against immigration and refugees for years. As part of my mad scramble to prepare for this program today, I did some research online. I found a nice USA Today story that says that the countries are Egypt, Iran, Iraq, Libya, Mali, North Korea, Somalia, Sudan, South Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. So if you're paying attention, apart from North Korea and South Sudan, Islam's the dominant religion in all the other ones. That's clearly part of the overall. This is sort of in keeping with what the president has described himself as his Muslim ban.
Yeah.
So Lauren made a really smart point. I just quickly want to tie everything we've talked about so far and say it's remarkable. It's a cliche to say that we live in the permanent campaign, but it's remarkable the extent to which this presidency and this White House use campaign style politics. If you think about everything we've talked about, if you think about the attacks on his Republican opponents, if you think about the feud with a Gold Star wife, if you think about the refugee situation, to me, they all tie back to big themes of his 2016 campaign. And it's very striking to me how he's keeping his voters together, the dossier as well. He's keeping his voters together by constantly talking about Hillary Clinton. He refers to his Electoral College victory. It's very striking to me how you can tie all these things together under that rubric.
And it's incredible that many Republicans, when he was on the campaign trail, said, when he is president, he will change.
He said the same thing, too. He'd be so presidential, we'd be bored. Remember that?
Yes, and we're very busy. I wouldn't say that we're very bored. And it's one of those things that moving forward, I think that Republicans cannot no longer say, just give him time. I think that this is the president, and this is who he is. And some voters love that, and some voters are deeply frustrated and concerned about that.
And that was Flake, right? Saying we can no longer pretend that he's going to become this different.
Right. But we get this comment from John Paul Spencer on Facebook who says, it is the height of moral cowardice to tell someone, well, I don't like your style, but I vote with you over 90% of the time. You can't hold your head high if at the heart of your political philosophy is a deep-seated misanthropy. We always welcome your comments and your questions as well. But let's stay with the issue of immigration. This week brought an end to a court battle. The Trump administration tried to block a teenager's abortion in Texas. The undocumented teen crossed the U.S.-Mexico border and then found out she was pregnant years later after a medical examination. A D.C. appeals court overturned the administration's block Wednesday. I guess not years later, maybe some months. But let's go back a little bit further. Why wasn't this teenager, Eugene, able to receive an abortion when she wanted one?
I think it had a lot to do with her status in terms of access also to healthcare and Texas in terms of not having places, healthcare clinics nearby that would be willing to provide her an abortion.
Yeah, they wouldn't let her leave the center, detention center.
Yeah, and so given her age, given her status, there were just lots of concerns in terms also of just, I think there's been a big focus on just how rare organizations and centers that provide access to abortion in the state of Texas are, just period.
And we should also say that when you're moving forward, you know, when you're traveling on these immigration, when you are crossing the border illegally, it can be very difficult to, you know, remain safe if you're a young woman. And this is a major issue for young women who are immigrating to this country.
The Friday News Roundup continues next. Stay close. We have time for a few more stories on the Friday News Roundup. Helping us get through the week's news today are Olivia Knox of Yahoo News, CNN congressional reporter Lauren Fox, and Eugene Scott of The Washington Post. Here's another story that is still with us, and very deservedly so. The allegations against Harvey Weinstein have set off an avalanche of sexual harassment and assault claims against an ever-growing list of high-profile figures. Political analyst Mark Halperin is out at NBC News and MSNBC after accusations of sexual harassment. And Dee Miller says to us on Twitter, the Mark Halperin accusations blew my mind. And former President George H.W. Bush was forced to apologize after allegedly groping at least two women. Then, of course, ousted Fox News star Bill O'Reilly found himself the subject of yet another New York Times expose, this time about a $32 million sexual harassment settlement that he made with a New York analyst. O'Reilly actually confronted the New York Times about its reporting during an interview with two journalists who are covering the story.
This is horrible. It's horrible what I went through. Horrible what my family went through. This is crap. and you know it. It's politically and financially motivated, and we can prove it with shocking information. But I'm not going to sit there in a courtroom for a year and a half and let my kids get beaten up every single day of their lives by a tabloid press who would sit there, and you know it.
O'Reilly has not revealed that shocking information he mentioned, but it seems like in the past, when we have seen sexual harassment claims like this mean that someone lost their job, at least temporarily, oftentimes it blows over, it exits the headlines pretty quickly, and very often that person ends up back working, if not for that same place, then another place. So, Lauren, is there something different this time around?
I think there is. I think women are starting to feel much more comfortable in the fact that their stories are going to be taken seriously, if they're going to come forward, that people are going to believe them. And I think moving forward, that means a lot, because it means that if you're a young woman working in any industry in this country, you should feel more empowered that the country is listening and watching what men do in the workplace. And I think that that's very empowering. And I don't think this story is going to go away. I mean, it seems like we have new men coming, women coming out all the time talking about a new man that we did not know was, you know, behaving this way. I think that's not going to change anytime soon.
But Eugene, exactly what Lauren just mentioned is why some men are saying, well, this is now a witch hunt. It's not credible anymore.
Absolutely. Yesterday, I did a story that included a poll that said at least one in four men believe, despite the recent increase in this issue, that we're still paying too much attention to it. And so many men don't understand the magnitude of this issue and don't understand what sexual harassment is, period. And I think what's really important is we saw Jane Fonda come out and talk about this yesterday, about the class and race component in this. The one reason I think that this has become a national issue, it's because of the wealth and the prominence and the power of those involved and the victims. We're talking about famous celebrities. But to Jane Fonda,
And Harvey Weinstein.
And the politicians involved as well. But I mean, anyone who studies this issue will tell you that working class women in the heartland who are waitresses deal with this type of thing from their bosses all the time and have been trying to get attention for this issue, and it's not following through.
Olivier, but we have seen, especially in politics, we have seen people come back time and time and again, despite allegations and since settlements, large settlements over sexual harassment and even sexual assault. So will it stick?
Boy, that's a great question. I don't know. I mean, it doesn't seem to be flagging. I remember some significant moments of sexual harassment in politics, but I guess the dam breaker here was probably Bill Cosby, right? In this last wave, and sort of the thinking that if this beloved figure could do it, then anyone could do it, which lent, again, I'm really just speculating from the gut here, but lent credibility to a lot of the accusers. You know, well, if he might do it, well, then sure Harvey Weinstein would do it, and sure these other people would do it. It does feel different. I can't say for sure how long this will last. I you're right that a lot of these people can make comebacks. You know, we have a lot of second chances in American life, despite the old adage that there are no second acts. Mm-hmm. I don't know the answer to that question. I don't.
All right. Well, it's been just over a month since Hurricane Maria slammed into Puerto Rico, more than 75% of the American territory still without power. Many places there are struggling to find food or even clean water. Cell service is spotty at best or non-existent. That means dozens of remote villages are essentially cut off. Congress passed a $36.5 billion disaster relief package on Tuesday. That measure grants Puerto Rico $4.9 billion worth of low-interest loans. Vox's Yochi Drazen just got back from a reporting trip to Puerto Rico. So good to have you with us.
Thank you.
And thanks for your reporting. What did you see on the island?
So I expected the devastation to be bad, but it was at a level that went far beyond what I expected. When you're in San Juan, in the capital, you don't feel it quite as much until nightfall. I mean, the city itself was not crushed. There are not collapsed buildings anywhere. But then at nightfall, you start to see the lights go out across the city. And then you're in this darkened metropolis. I used to live in Baghdad, and it reminded me of that. Not in terms of the damage, but just sitting in a city where buildings are dark, restaurants are dark. I went to Old San Juan, which is in some ways the biggest tourist attraction in San Juan, seven blocks until I saw another human being. There were just dogs in the street, but everything in Old San Juan, everything was shuttered. When you go to the mountains in the center of the island, which is where the storm really did the most damage, there are houses where they're just gone. You see the foundation of where a house was, but the structure is decimated. Power lines, not just the lines themselves are down, but there are high capacity lines which bring power from the generators to the distribution lines. Those are either underground or on heavy concrete structures. The concrete was just snapped in half like a twig. And the idea that power will be back by Christmas, which is what the governor of Puerto Rico is now saying, I mentioned that to one of the officials from the federal government I was interviewing, and he literally burst out laughing. This is a U.S. territory that will be without power certainly into next spring, possibly longer. It is, the grid is just gone. I mean, the generators are for the most part intact, which is good, but the lines that carry the power are gone. The distribution system is mostly gone and has to be rebuilt from scratch, and the government has no money. The utility filed for bankruptcy. The government of Puerto Rico basically has filed for bankruptcy. $4.9 billion in loans is an almost comically small amount.
We have heard a lot of different analysis of the government's response in Puerto Rico. Did you see FEMA workers or government workers while you were there?
I did. I thought that the response, now that it's gotten going, was actually kind of impressive to see. There are about 10,000 federal troops on the island, a huge FEMA presence, a huge Army Corps of Engineer presence. Many of them said a variant of what Donald Trump had said. And because it was Donald Trump...
Are you talking about the thing where he gave himself 10 out of 10?
No. When he had said that it's an island surrounded by all this water, and he was kind of widely mocked, but they all said variants of that, that was pretty much true. With Hurricane Katrina or other parts of the U.S., mainland U.S. hit by Maria, you could drive supplies in, and it's impossible to overstate how hard it is if they have to come in by boat or by plane. It's very expensive if they come by plane. It's very slow if they come by boat. And so Trump's initial comment about how hard, that this is uniquely difficult was echoed by the actual disaster relief professionals. Because with Donald Trump, because some of his comments have been so cruel and callous towards the island, it took on a different resonance. But the substance of it was echoed by the professionals on the ground.
And what are the people of Puerto Rico, what is their view of the arguments going on between the mayor, for example, and Donald Trump and all of the rhetoric that's flying around? How do they see this?
So the people in the city who followed it most closely because they have some internet access understand the bind that the governor is in. They understand that unless he sucks up to Trump, he'll get nothing. And that if you're like the mayor and you pick a fight, even if that fight is justified, the response from the administration is just violent, not violence in a literal sense, but rhetorical violence and pushback, you know, that she may not get aid. So they know that in the city that the governor's in a bind. What was interesting to me was in the center of the country where, again, there's no phones, no power, no internet. All the same, everyone I spoke to had seen the images of Donald Trump throwing paper towels into the crowd. That image across the island, people remember it. And the level of fury towards him, you know, he likes to give himself a 10 out of 10 on the recovery. Yeah. If you want to rate the level of fury towards him on a scale of 1 to 10, you're at about a 20. There was just sheer rage, almost sort of people would occasionally be sputtering and wordless about it because they just couldn't understand how they are U.S. citizens, they are members of the United States, they have fought and died in American wars, and they just don't understand why they're being treated as cruelly as they feel like they're being treated by this president.
And we have a comment from Ludo who asks on Facebook, what about that shady power grid contract in Puerto Rico? I'm glad that you mentioned that. You're talking about this small for-profit company called Whitefish Energy. It landed a $300 million contract to repair Puerto Rico's decimated electric grid. The mayor of San Juan says it needs to be canceled. Basically, there's two full-time employees for this company. How did it get this $300 million contract?
So I think the two questions that will hover over this are, one, did they get it because they're close to Ryan Zinke?
They're financed by a major Trump donor.
Right. So this isn't just a random small company. So the one question, in some ways, the more important one is, can they do the work? And with such a small staff who've never done this before, it seems kind of doubtful. Then the other is, did they get it nefariously? Because they're close to the Interior Secretary of the United States, because they are close to the Trump campaign. Again, you don't want to overstate the comparisons to Iraq, but when it comes to reconstruction, there's the same concern. At some point, Puerto Rico will get more than $4.9 billion. It's a bankrupt island that does not have a good financial system. And like with Iraq, when you put that kind of money into a small place, contractors descend, and there's a literal gold rush. And then there's the question of, how are those contracts awarded? Are they awarded fairly? Are they overseen fairly? The initial contract to Whitefish does not give much reason for hope.
Eugene, what about these contracts and how they're awarded? How important an issue is this for the Trump administration?
It is very important considering someone who campaigned on wanting to drain the swamp, right, and get rid of pay for play, and something that he accused the Clinton campaign of, and some point to as one of the reasons that we have seen a bit of the downfall of the Clinton nonprofit. And so whether or not these people were proven to be the best people to be able to do something like this, which I can't imagine there's a lot of material for, considering how small they are and how new they are to this.
Zero experience.
Yeah,
I
think people are concerned. And I think another piece of this conversation that we have to entertain and not leave out is that the U.S. Virgin Islands is faring even worse. People aren't talking about what's happening with the U.S. Virgin Islands, and their representative has come out very vocally saying, we wish we could get some of the attention that Puerto Rico has been getting.
I'm Celeste Headlee, sitting in for Joshua Johnson today. You're listening to 1A. Olivier, what do you make of this? Because there is so much to talk about when it comes to Puerto Rico. Is the contractors that Yochi mentioned that are now going to maybe start flooding onto the island, is that one of the more important issues?
For Puerto Rico, certainly. I mean, we're talking about a possibly a decades-long reconstruction project. It is interesting to see...
Which means other administrations will end up having their hands on that.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And then you're going to see one of the questions, too, is what sort of congressional scrutiny you're going to get and from whom? Because obviously Puerto Rico not being a state, they don't have a representative or senators who might drive that. Now, there are Puerto Rican populations in American states, and so you get some attention from those lawmakers. But I think they're really going to be hamstrung in this process by not having their own representation.
Margaret comments, this will be 45's Katrina. Lauren, what if it's not the awarding of contracts, what do you think is the most important issue coming out of Puerto Rico, and how lasting will be what Yochi was talking about, this rage over tossing paper towels and the reaction with the mayor?
This is a test of presidential leadership. I think every natural disaster, every unexpected moment in your presidency becomes a test of leadership. And people in Puerto Rico, I mean, I haven't spoken with them, but, you know, given what we've heard this morning, I think it's very clear that President Trump is not meeting that test. These are his voters. These are people who are American citizens. And I think that that is going to stay with him. And a lot of people who may not live in Puerto Rico are still going to look at that situation. A lot of people in Florida, a lot of people in Texas are going to look at this and say, this is what our president can do. Really? This is it?
Yochi, we have heard that there have been some positive developments. We heard that Elon Musk got one of the power systems up and running. We have heard that they're beginning to helicopter some supplies into remote villages. What's the priority on the ground? Because it could be power. It could be water. What's the number one need?
Power. Because without power, the water system can't come back up. Sewage doesn't come back up. Cell phone networks don't come back up. Right now, the priority FEMA has is to bring generators until the grid is back up, temporary generators to hospitals, medical centers, water filtration systems, sewage systems. They want to get the infrastructure back up, even if it's reliant on generators. That has its own complication because generators need diesel fuel. So you have to get first the generator itself, then the fuel. But right now, that's the priority. There is progress. Recently, a port in a place called Ponce was reopened. This is in the center of the island, which means supplies don't have to all come through San Juan. So there are little gains. I was genuinely impressed by FEMA. Some of the areas that I drove through, the trees still block the road. There are still mudslides, so a road is clear one day and it's blocked the next. There is an interesting political side to this, which is many of the Puerto Ricans I spoke to, I probably interviewed close to 70, many of them have said the island is dead. It's not coming back from this. We're moving to the mainland. If they have family, if they have a way to go, they all said they want to go. And this was across the wealthier Puerto Ricans I spoke to, the people who were on the other end of the spectrum. And if they go, they're mostly going to Florida. And so you don't want to sort of take a human catastrophe and make it politics, but there is a political element to this. If you have 100,000 furious Puerto Ricans moving to the mainland, eager to punish Donald Trump and Republicans they feel enabled him, they'll be in a state that they could easily have an impact and try to do that.
And there's reporting that says thousands have already moved from Puerto Rico to Florida, and it's centered more often around the like Orlando area. And so I think that's something to pay a lot of attention to when the midterms come up.
A lot of our listeners have questions about this. Amy in New Hampshire writes, wouldn't this be the time to put major solar power in Puerto Rico instead of rebuilding the traditional grid? Give everybody a solar array for their house, business, etc. I think, Amy, that is Elon Musk's suggestion also. And Hector writes, why is it that Republicans are talking about raising the deficit to give tax cuts to the wealthy, but when it comes time to help out those in need, we can only give them loans and paper towels. Can we be more offensive to those in need? Olivier, do you want to handle that one?
Thanks for handing me that one.
Sure.
Well, the idea of trickle-down economics of tax cuts for the rich is a long-standing core Republican position.
Yeah.
Dating back chiefly to the Reagan era. Not everyone is getting loans. This is actually a point of some dispute on Capitol Hill. There are places that are getting grants and getting help, just not Puerto Rico.
We have just a minute left, and I want to talk about James Comey, the former FBI director. Seems to have confirmed he actually is the owner of the Twitter account from Reinhold Niebuhr. Anyone else follow him and him already? You agree? You think this is it?
For sure.
You think it's it?
For sure.
Okay.
I love the pensive photo he tweeted out of himself standing on a road in Iowa.
With running shoes.
Running shoes.
I want to say thanks to all my Friday Roundup guests, CNN congressional reporter Lauren Fox, Washington Post reporter Eugene Scott, and Olivier Knox, chief Washington correspondent for Yahoo News. And thanks to Yochi Dreisen of Vox as well. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Celeste Headlee. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.